for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The FCC is expected to vote today on regulation that would prohibit broadband internet providers from offering faster delivery speeds to some types of content. Today's vote won't settle the long-standing debate over the issue, but most agree it's significant for net neutrality proponents. Joining me to explain what all this means and implications for companies and consumers, Jeffrey Eisenach of the American Enterprise Institute, Cecilia Kang of the Washington Post, joining us from New York, Susan Crawford of Harvard's Kennedy School, and the Harvard University School of Law. You're invited to be part of the program. Give us a call. Give us your thoughts. 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Great to be here.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Cecilia. The FCC commissioners are meeting this morning. Postponed. Why? Do we know?
Because as we speak, there is snow still falling in Washington. So there's just a one-hour delay. But for our listeners who are really watching this closely, the meeting will still commence this morning, but at 10:30 instead of 9:30.
And explain what they'll be voting on.
So they will be voting on net neutrality, the idea that all web traffic should be treated equally on the internet. And how they're going to do that is to vote on specifically on a proposal that does two things that really stand out among many things, is to classify broadband internet as a communications service. And that means to classify it for the first time ever with the same sort of rules that a public utility like a phone or electric service would have. And this other thing they will do is to classify all broadband, including wireless. So this will, with these rules, they will ensure that there is no ability to block or slow down any particular traffic on the internet.
And I gather the vote is expected to go on party lines.
It certainly is, which means it will probably pass, most certainly will pass. There are three Democrats and two Republicans, and so the majority that's led by the chairman, who is also a Democrat, Tom Wheeler, those three are expected to vote in favor of this proposal.
Jeff, you said this is a really big deal. Explain how big.
Well, I think it is a big deal. And first of all, I think it's important to understand that the internet's not going to change one way or another tomorrow, in part because this decision is going to be challenged in court. Congress is also looking at it. So there's a lot of things, a lot of other steps down the road. But it's a big deal because we are, for the first time, going to stop the consensus we've had for a decade on public light touch regulation of the internet and move to a public utility model like we had for AT&T back in the 1960s. And that didn't work very well for AT&T, and a lot of us think it won't work very well for the internet.
Why not?
Well, the internet is very rapidly moving. It's very dynamic and very innovative. So while net neutrality advocates would say, well, we need to prevent discrimination, there's really no evidence there's ever been harmful discrimination. But the internet is full of new business models in which treating different things differently is the essence of the business model. So now every time you want to treat something differently from something else, you're going to have to go ask permission from the FCC, and that's going to slow down innovation.
All right, let's move to Susan Crawford. You see this as a major victory for net neutrality. Proponents, explain why.
Well, more than 4 million Americans wrote in to the FCC, suddenly bringing telecommunications policy into the center of the public dialogue, and it hasn't been there. Everybody understands that high-speed internet access is the modern-day equivalent of phone service. We treated high-speed internet access as what Jeffrey's referring to, a Title II service, between 1998 and 2006 or so, and then deregulated. We took a sudden step off this steady path, and now we're returning to the ordinary treatment of basic two-way communications networks, which is to ensure that we have a cop on the beat. Otherwise, our private providers have a built-in conflict of interest to favor their own commercial interests.
It's interesting to me that when you and I have talked previously, you thought it was going the other way. You were concerned about the FCC, what it might do. Why the reversal here in fortune for those who support net neutrality?
Well, a few things happened over the summer and the fall that changed the complexion of this issue. One was a wrenching customer service call experienced by a Comcast customer. The tape was played to millions of people. The Comcast customer was trying to exit the service, and the guy just wouldn't let him go. And that resonated with a lot of people. Terrible customer service, nothing to do about it. Then John Oliver made a funny video about net neutrality and woke up a lot of people up to the importance, the salience of this issue, and the ridiculousness of not doing anything about it. And then the president weighed in November saying that he would urge the FCC to do what Cecilia has described, to relabel high-speed internet access as a matter of administrative choice, discretion, so that there could be a cop on the beat when it comes to this essential facility.
Susan Crawford, she's co-director of the Berkman Center at Harvard University and author of Captive Audience. We do look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Jeffrey, explain for us the difference between level one and level two classifications and the arguments as to why internet service providers should be classified as level two. I don't get that.
So the reference is to provisions of the Communications Act of 1934. Title one is the provision which gives the FCC broad authority to act in the public interest. And the last time the FCC issued regulations on net neutrality in 2010, those were overturned by the D.C. Circuit in the beginning of last year. The court decided that that provision of the law was not sufficient to allow the FCC to impose those rules. So the FCC went back to the drawing board. Title II is just another provision of the law, and it is the provision of the law that relates to common carriers, or as we've said, public utilities. And what it does is it puts the FCC in charge of setting both rates and terms and conditions for the regulated service. So that's the service, that's the provision which is always, which applied to telephone companies back when they were a monopoly. It mostly doesn't apply to them now.
Cecilia.
Oh, that's right. So this is the reason why they're reclassifying to Title II, because in 2010 they were sued by Verizon saying that you don't have the authority to impose these net neutrality rules because broadband internet is an information service, which is lightly regulated. So there's been a lot of wrangling and debate and a ton of lobbying over whether the FCC should just reclassify, get on stronger legal ground, because they surely will be sued again. And this was something that actually this chairman was reluctant to do until very recently. As you noted, Diane, he's had a change of heart. And going forward, he believes, and his staff believes, that they would have the most bulletproof legal grounding to enforce net neutrality going forward if they say that broadband internet in 2015 is such a vital utility service that it should be labeled as such.
Equivalent to water or gas or anything.
The idea, and well, I think the best reference is the phone. The phone is a utility because that's within the same paradigm. But and that would be, and it really is sort of a philosophical change of heart, really federally. This is a historical move. I think we might look back in 10 years and see that during this administration, the internet was for the first time regulated in a way where the administration acknowledged how important the internet was.
Susan.
And just a couple points on this. Back in 2002, what happened was that the then chairman, Powell, now head of the Cable Trade Association, told us that he thought that competition would protect Americans when it came to high-speed internet access and that we didn't need a regulatory cop on the beat. in the years since then, we've seen tremendous consolidation to the point where for connections of 25 megabits or more, most Americans have just one choice. So there's been a change of the facts on the ground, and also we've learned that without this solid legal footing, the FCC is just going to be wrangling forever. So as an administrative matter, they are changing their mind, and administrative agencies get to do that.
How much did President Obama's weighing in tilt the scales here, Jeffrey?
Well, if you don't mind, first let me just address what's happened since 2002 very quickly, right? Since 2002, Verizon has built out fiber, and other companies have built out fiber to large portions of America where we don't have fiber. We have very fast DSL service provided by the other phone companies, AT&T. Cable companies have built out cable modem service, which is now dozens of times faster than it was in 2002. So the notion that competition has failed is wrong. And I hope we'll talk more about this, but the politicization of this process, I think, has been to not to anyone's credit.
Jeffrey Eisenach, he's director of the Center for Internet Communications and Technology Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. Short break. We'll talk further. Take your calls. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college and career and supporting innovation that can improve public schools at gatesfoundation.org. From the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Talking about the Federal Communications Commission ruling expected today to rule that the internet companies should be operating under rules of net neutrality. And here with me, Cecilia Kang, entertainment and technology reporter for The Washington Post, Jeffrey Eisenach of the American Enterprise Institute, and Susan Crawford. She's co-director of the Berkman Center at Harvard University and author of Captive Audience. Cecilia, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that President Obama weighed in on this. How much did his weighing in affect, do you believe, the decision of the FCC?
I believe it had a huge influence on the decision of the FCC to put forth these rules, this chairman. When President Obama issued his statement and he made a video statement where he appeared, he called specifically for what he said, quote, the strongest rules possible on the internet for net neutrality. And he specifically said he favored the idea of Title II reclassification, which is what we've been discussing. And that actually was much more specific than Obama has ever been. And let's keep in mind, he's near the end of his tenure in this administration. He's had two chairmen who have attempted to create net neutrality rules that will stick. One set of rules by his first chairman, Julius Genachowski, got overturned in court, and it appeared that Tom Wheeler, the chairman currently, was about to propose rules that would be some sort of compromise that the telecommunications and cable industry could possibly like, as well as the internet companies. But that those sorts of compromises haven't worked in the past. So when the president issued a strong opinion that we should go, that the FCC should go in a specific direction, that was huge. That is controversial in the sense that the FCC is an independent agency. And I don't mean controversial in the sense I don't know what sort of communication was between the two. They do communicate somewhat. But it was, you know, keep in mind, this was a big nudge.
Jeffrey.
Well, a big nudge indeed, and really unprecedented. You know, the only example that some of the defenders of President Obama's intervention can cite goes back to the Nixon administration. When you're citing President Nixon for ethics issues, for defense and your ethics issues, you ought to be questioning what you're doing.
People have said it's like Nixon going to China.
Well, actually, the president has been, you know, very supportive of net neutrality going back to 2008, and it's been part of his political agenda to get this done. But the politicization of an issue, this is an issue which is extremely complex, and we tried to take, the reason we created agencies like the Federal Communications Commission is to take these complex economic issues, which have tremendous consequences, winners and losers, billions of dollars, to take them out of the political environment, put them in a less politicized environment. And when you look at the 4 million comments and the protesters at the FCC, you know, that's really not the way the process is supposed to work.
All right. Susan, here's an email which says one of the main arguments the cable companies seem to be making is our bills will be going up if there's net neutrality. He asks, when is the last time our bills have gone down? But isn't it more true that my bills will go up without neutrality? I mean, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, won't they all cost me more with these rules?
Well, the risk to new sources of content, over-the-top video, is that in the absence of a regime like this, they won't be able to get their material to you without paying the freight to the cable distributor. Look, this whole issue is a lot simpler than Jeffrey's painting it. All the FCC is doing is saying we need to be on firm legal footing when we issue rules that go to non-discrimination when it comes to high-speed internet access. So far, the D.C. Circuit has knocked them down twice when they tried to do it under another section of the Act. The House of Cards has fallen. Now the FCC is moving forward, and it knows what it's doing, and it will be deferred to. And it's not going to price regulate.
Won't Congress have a lot to say here, Susan?
Well, there's unlimited campaign contributions in this world, so yes, they will have. They'll be holding hearings. The thing is, we have a perfectly good act, and the FCC has acted under the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and it's serving its purpose, and we're moving ahead. Until we have a different act, the FCC is doing its job.
How is the Congress likely to move on this issue?
Sure. Well, this actually might light a little bug under some of the Republicans and as well as Democrats to consider more seriously legislation, because for so many years there's been talk about a refresh of the Communications Act to really try to take in mind the reality today of the internet environment. So there may be legislative move, but it's a long journey to create some sort of a legislation that everybody can agree on.
So what you're saying is if the FCC rules as we expect mm-hmm. them to today, those rules would stay in place
yes.
until Congress may figure out a way to go in another direction.
Which could be years, and it will stay in place unless it's potentially stayed in court or potentially or overturned. And again, if it's overturned in court, that would take years as well.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, when Susan says this is just a administrative issue of what title of the Communications Act you're going to apply. In fact, it's a very extreme movement to the point that people who have supported net neutrality in the past, including Google and Eric Schmidt, have lobbied against the imposition of Title II regulations. So what you have here is a tremendous regulatory overreach on behalf of the Obama administration. In terms of what Congress will do, it is tough for Congress to pass legislation. Senator Thune and Congressman Upton and Walden have introduced legislation which would provide for non-discrimination, for no blocking, for no throttling, for basically all the things that the goals that the FCC has set it wants to pursue. But the Democrats in the Senate are refusing to even consider that legislation.
Susan, Jeffrey mentioned Google as one of the companies changing its mind on this. What about companies that at one time supported net neutrality and now are rethinking their position?
The simplicity and appropriateness of this move is supported by an article that just came out in Cecilia's newspaper, The Washington Post, where Google said Title II will not interfere with our investments in fiber across the country. We've seen hundreds of startups support the idea of reclassification. They don't want their destinies to be dependent on the whim of a few cable distributors. So, in fact, Facebook is not opposing what the commission is doing. I would say the online companies are behind the FCC as it moves to reclaim the regulatory ideal, which is to make the free market work. That's the point of this, not having a few actors make all the decisions.
What about the extent to which the Silicon Valley organizations are in support or not, Cecilia?
In this latest round of net neutrality, the interesting thing is that some of the smaller companies have been most vocal. They've talked to folks in the White House. They've been lobbying the FCC aggressively. They've organized. These include companies like Etsy and Tumblr and Mozilla. These companies actually have been sort of they've sort of taken the torch in the way that Google and Facebook and Yahoo did in 2008, 2009. With the last set of rules. So it is interesting that the bigger companies, I agree with Susan in that they tend to support these rules, but they've been a lot more quiet. They're also, their businesses are more diversified too. They're a little bit conflicted in some ways. That doesn't mean that they necessarily oppose these rules at all, but they have not been as vocal. And also some of them feel a little bit burned about the last process. It was a difficult, long lobbying war that they lost last time.
Jeff, tell me what it is that the telecom companies fear so much.
Well, I think it's, there are two ways to organize an economy. One way is everything is permitted except what's specifically prohibited. And the other way is everything is prohibited except what's specifically permitted. We're moving from the first way to the second way now. Everything now is prohibited on the Internet except what will be permitted by the Federal Communications Commission. So if, for example, you would like to launch a new business model, let's say ESPN would like to be able to provide customers, watchers of ESPN, the ability to watch video on ESPN without having their data caps affected on their mobile broadband plans. That is now suspect, will be suspect going forward under these rules, and in effect will require the permission from the Federal Communications Commission before ESPN can go out and enter into a deal like that with AT&T or Verizon.
Susan, is that how you see it?
Well, I feel I've entered into some upside-down land. Actually, what's going on is that we're returning to the ideal of Internet access as a permission-free world where anybody can launch a new system, a new service online, an online application, without asking permission from a gatekeeper. That's what has made the Internet flourish for the last few years and generate so much economic growth and democracy around the world. So we're supporting that ideal, not getting in its way.
All right, I'm going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Fred in Houston, Texas. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think that everything needs to be sped up and it needs to be free. Because, you know, think about all the kids today. The more they surf the web, the more they learn. The faster the web is, the more they can surf. You know, we're so far behind other countries in our education. It seems like this is a no-brainer to make this free and available for everybody.
All right. What's your thinking there, Cecilia?
Well, I think his comments sort of highlight the general feeling in the population. This is why 4 million people commented on this issue at the FCC, that the Internet needs has become such a vital part of our society, our economy, our education system, healthcare, et cetera. And so the idea that there could be any sort of encumbering of the internet, there could be any sort of new structure where certain companies get preference over other companies, how that some sites might be slower, that in just in the very basic, that your cable or phone company can control your access to the internet is very disturbing. That's why it's actually become this very wonky word. Net neutrality has become such a mainstream interest at this point.
All right, to Bill in Richmond, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I teach at a community college here, and many of my students come from rural areas. And I'm interested in what you have to say about how FCC oversight could increase accessibility for them. Everything that we do at the college now is digital. And some of my students can't get the videos that I would like to use in my teaching because of limited accessibility. They call the commercial companies and they say, well, the population's not dense enough where you live for you to warrant us providing service to you.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that the net neutrality regulations, the last thing they do is either promote additional broadband deployment or do anything really to protect consumers. And it's important for people to understand that the net neutrality rules do not prohibit consumers from paying ISPs for faster service. The net neutrality rules prohibit companies, other corporations, from paying the ISPs for faster service so that the ISPs can charge consumers less. So for those who are interested in more rapid broadband deployment and better broadband infrastructure, net neutrality is exactly the wrong remedy.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Susan.
Well, actually, you've reframed this issue. This reclassification today puts the FCC on a stronger footing to deploy many other policies that do affect the way the private market so far has rolled out high-speed internet access. Left to their own devices, these companies will systematically charge a lot to rich urban areas, leave out poor and rural areas, and make as much money as they can from the facilities they build. That's not evil. It's just the way a profit-making business works. The FCC's ability to subsidize better service in rural areas, to make sure that schools and libraries get world-class internet connections, all of those policies are helped by calling high-speed internet access a basic telecommunication service.
All right, to Jerry in South Miami, Florida, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is history repeating itself, Diane. I'm halfway through reading The Bully Pulpit, and the same thing was going on when Roosevelt was running for re-election in 1903 and after he was elected in 1904. That time it was regarding regulating the railroads for exactly the same reasons. And Roosevelt said that above all else, we must strive to keep the highways of commerce open to all on equal terms. The railroads were cheating their customers and doing all kinds of things to benefit the very people up at the top. And today, the internet is the highway of commerce.
Do you agree with that, Susan?
I do. The analogy is exact. There's also an exact analogy to the course of electrification. We followed the same path there, where private companies controlled it, a lot of people were left out, and eventually the government stepped in.
Jeffrey.
Well, if you look at public utilities in the United States, look at their productivity growth, look at the rate at which they're improving, and you compare that to what's happened with the internet, it's orders of magnitude better with the internet. Your electricity service hasn't gotten any better in the last decade. If you want to see the future of the internet under Title II, look at the U.S. Postal Service and its 28-year-old trucks. That's a public utility in the United States. And when Susan says, well, all we need to do is declare this a public utility and we'll have fast, improved service everywhere, look at the post office.
Cecilia.
Well, I think, no company wants regulation or more regulation. I think that's just a truism. And so the idea that when you ask what are the cable and telecom companies afraid of, they're afraid of a new regime of regulation that they've never had to live under for a particular, for the fastest growing part of their business.
That could do what?
That could place all kinds of rules, but keep in mind, we haven't read the order yet, but the FCC has actually promised to forbear, which means essentially to opt out of certain things, such as rate regulation. That's a huge thing that may be sort of the future of these cable and telecom businesses, is as they see their broadband internet subscriptions increase, but their TV subscriptions decrease, their business going forward is broadband. So they want to be able to control their prices. And from what we've heard, the FCC has said, we won't touch that. Go ahead.
Well, I think they will start out saying, you know, we're going to forbear from this and have a light touch on that. But the reality is much more likely that they'll be regulating the entire system.
Jeffrey Eisenach, the American Enterprise Institute. Short break here. More of your calls, your email, when we come back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that every business is in the software business. CA Software and Services work to help companies optimize their digital transformation in the application economy. More information is at ca.com. And from Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring automation tools for creating personalized emails to reach contacts on their individual schedules with messages that are relevant and personalized. Learn more at myemma.com/automation.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, tens of millions of Americans take nutritional supplements. New studies allege some pills do not contain what's on the label. Other research indicates consumers may be ingesting too many vitamins. New concerns about dietary supplements. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We are awaiting, as we speak, the FCC's ruling on net neutrality. I have two emails to read to you, one a little on the long side and another very, very short. The first from Daniel. He says, as an IT consultant, a client of mine wanted to use a cloud-based backup system. We chose a vendor, started the initial backup. 5 days later, the backup was only about 5% done. Without getting too technical, the client had a super fast internet connection, should have been able to complete it within hours. After looking into it, I found the internet service provider my client used happens to be the exclusive bandwidth provider for a competing service. On a hunch, I signed up for a trial with the service, was able to complete the backup within 4 hours. Mm. It seems obvious that my client's ISP is deliberately slowing down traffic, destined for their competition, which limits consumer choice. I feel anti-competitive tactics like this should be illegal and hopefully will be under net neutrality rules. Here is an opposing perspective from Alan in Hedgeville. You're making this much more difficult than it needs to be. Not to put too fine a point on it, the government makes almost everything it touches worse. That would include the internet. Susan.
When it comes to roads and trains and telephones and telegraphs, there has always been a set of public obligations that we impose on the private actors who sell those services to us. You know, high-speed internet access is no different. I don't disagree that it wouldn't be great for the government to be running high-speed internet access, and that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about ensuring that the private actors can be trusted with our speech and the speech of all American companies.
Jeffrey.
Well, I obviously agree with the second commenter. I think when you move to a public utility model, you're moving to a model, once again, where you have to ask permission before you can engage in any new business models. The innovation that's happened on the internet over the last 20 years without Title II regulation is innovation that's happened because of the light-touch regulatory approach that we've had in place since the Clinton administration.
And Cecilia, give me your thoughts on that first email.
This first email really points to the context, and very importantly, for why this is all happening. There is not a lot of competition, particularly on what's known as the wireline side of high-speed internet. And so for most people, for most Americans, you have the choice of one or two high-speed internet providers. And so this is the context from which the chairman of the FCC today is trying to figure out what are the rules that we need to put in place to make sure that those one or two people don't have too much control. And so I should note that this is also in the context of what will be one of the biggest cable mergers that's currently under review in the federal government, Comcast's bid for Time Warner Cable. And so when you see potentially even more consolidation in that industry, which has become so important, the federal government is right now trying to consider all these pieces of the puzzle to come up with what they believe right now the FCC will be the best way to, as I said, make sure that those providers do not have too much control.
All right, let's go to Johnson City, Tennessee. Russell, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is for your American Enterprise guest. Here in Tennessee, here in Johnson City, the local power board put in fiber optic cable for their smart utility grid, and they wanted to offer internet with it since they had excess bandwidth, and many other cities have wanted to offer this as well. And apparently this was such competition that the cable companies here in Tennessee had the legislature pass a bill outlawing such utility use. Therefore, last month I faced the choice of either going back to 3 megabits per second or paying double the rate I'd been paying for my cable access. How is competition making my life better?
Well, in Tennessee, actually, you all have the Chattanooga experiment, where the city of Chattanooga has spent hundreds of millions, billions of dollars putting in a high-speed gigabit internet service, which I think last time we looked had about 7 subscribers for its very fast internet. Now, I don't think there's anyone who thinks that we ought to be excluding competition from the market, and that law is one I'd like to look at more closely. But in general, new entry into the broadband marketplace ought to be permitted and has been permitted under the Telecommunications Act of 1996. The other thing, I guess, it's important to understand, the question here is not between no rules and some rules. The question is between public utility-style regulation and a case-by-case approach that would address the kind of problems, the discrimination problems that the previous emailer talked about. It is important that we not allow anti-competitive discrimination on the Internet. No one debates that question. The question is, should we treat it like the electric company or the post office.
Susan, I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, I want to jump in and congratulate the caller for raising another huge issue before the FCC today. In fact, the first one they're moving on this morning is preempting state laws that remove from cities the choice of whether to call for their own fiber network and, in essence, create a public option that has the potential to be cheaper and faster and better and with a public service mandate at its heart. So that's happening this morning as well, because Chattanooga can't expand its network beyond its boundaries because the state law in Tennessee doesn't permit it. Now, Jeffrey keeps mentioning public utility rules. The chairman has said over and over again that he's not going to be doing rate regulation or tariffing, which are classic public utility elements. And so far, the FCC, once it forbears from something, has never changed its mind.
You know, it's so interesting because even as we speak, the FCC is talking about Tennessee, talking about the grid, talking about providing the route to the internet there. So I'm glad you called, Russell. And let's go now to Matt in Silver Spring, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to challenge the idea that the telecommunications companies are against this legislation. Nobody's seen it, and it sounds a lot like every other time this has happened where nobody knows what it is, but if the rates go up and they make more money. And also the pattern of more bureaucrats getting involved and then them going and working for the industries that they're supposed to be overseeing.
Cecilia.
Yes.
Well, the telecommunications companies and cable companies, the biggest ones, including AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, have all expressed opposition to the idea of reclassification, Title II. They've agreed that there some rules are, you know, are warranted. They'd like to keep things within the same regime, though, Title I, with some rules. And a lot of the wireless companies, as you would imagine, would not like those rules to apply to them. So, yeah, they're not so happy with these rules.
Jeffrey.
Well, you know, historically, the Federal Communications Commission has been prone to exactly the kind of problem that the caller refers to, and that's why economists call it rent-seeking. But basically, it's lobbyists and lawyers and economists showing up, arguing why their particular interest ought to get a bigger part of the pie than somebody else's. And that's really where, you know, a lot of the edge provider companies started out in this whole process. I do want to come back and point out that Google and others have gotten off the Title II boat because they realize that this is potential for the FCC to reach out and regulate the entire internet. Somebody referred to Tumblr still supporting this. And I would just say I would encourage anyone who wants to see what happens when an issue gets politicized to go Google David Karp, K-A-R-P, and net neutrality. And you'll see a video with him on CNBC a couple days ago in which he explained that he supported net neutrality but really didn't understand the concept of monopoly and couldn't quite do a very good job explaining why. So those are the folks who are in a political environment, you know, end up being the influential speakers. That's, again, not the way the process was supposed to work.
Susan.
Well, the telecom industry has invested for decades to keep the deregulatory world in place and make the FCC irrelevant. Today, the FCC is finally acting. So, yes, there has been rent-seeking, but a lot of it has gone the telecom community's way, and now the table is turning.
It's that's right. And I should say that there is a, historically, there was, in the early 2000s, a move to deregulate what's known as the Cable Modem Act, to deregulate broadband internet. And that actually is maybe the sort of start of this whole journey on net neutrality. And the person who did do that was the chairman of the FCC then, Michael Powell, who is now the president of the cable lobbying industry.
Mm. Well, if I can just say, let's remember the fellow who chose not to impose heavy-handed regulation on the internet was Bill Kennard, who was the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission under President Clinton. So this decision didn't happen under the Bush administration or Michael Powell.
Cecilia, let me ask you whether these new rules will dictate how much network owners can charge internet companies to connect with them at the front end?
I think that's the big question going forward. What you're referring to, I believe, is interconnection rates. This is, for example, what Netflix would have to pay a Verizon to make sure that all of their traffic is as close to their Verizon customers as possible, and they're delivered with the best quality. And we actually saw the real world result, or actually what that actually means, play out about a year ago when Netflix was not paying what's known as interconnection rates. And Netflix customers began to see that little pinwheel on their Netflix, this buffering that was occurring. And what Netflix did, which was kind of a clever PR move, is they put a notice on their site saying, this is essentially because we are, you know, Verizon is, you know, charging us rates that we don't think that we should. I mean, I'm summarizing. But that's what's known as interconnection. As to whether the FCC plans to regulate that part of the way the internet works and internet traffic works is actually still to be seen. So people will look very closely at that today.
Susan.
I'm confident the FCC is not going to get into a complicated rate-making evaluation of an ISP's cost. There will be some kind of process that will evaluate whether ISPs are charging tolls. But the FCC has been very lively about this, saying we're not going to get into setting prices for anything here.
Jeffrey.
Well, every interest group will have a right to petition the FCC for FCC intervention. So anyone who wants lower prices or thinks that somebody else's business practice is harming their business is going to show up at the FCC with their lawyers, economists, and lobbyists and say, make it better for us, and then the other side will have to respond. So the notion that the FCC can kind of stay out of this and wash its hands is just wrong under the law.
You think they'll be forced to be in?
Well, if you look at what happened under railroad regulation, you had the shippers, you had the railroads, you had the labor unions. Everybody shows up before the Interstate Commerce Commission with bevies of lawyers and lots of money and lobbyists demanding that their particular interests be served. And that's the slippery slope that the FCC embarks on today.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Cecilia, what kinds of lawsuits lie ahead?
Well, we'll have to look within the order to see what the legal grounding is for the lawsuits, but you can expect them. Some of it might be based on the precedents of the past, that the FCC in the past determined that, you know, that internet broadband was an information service, so why change your mind now? So they'd want to argue whether the merits today of reclassification makes sense. There could be various other legal lawsuits as well, but we have to look at the order and see.
Susan.
We can anticipate that the incumbents will claim that the FCC shouldn't change its mind, that deregulatory decision by now cable lobbyist Powell was the right one. Well, luckily, the Supreme Court keeps saying that we should defer to administrative agencies when they're acting sensibly, when they have a good reason to do what they're doing. And Justice Scalia turns out to be the strongest voice on that point, saying that your only question when you're looking at what this administrative agency is doing is, have they stayed within the bounds of their statutory authority? Do they have good reasons for their new policy? And I assure you that the FCC has displayed awareness that it's changing its position, and it has a good reason to do so.
All right. To Spencer in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Net neutrality is the back door for the fairness doctrine on the web. The FCC will eventually require a license for websites, kind of like it does for radio and TV, and use the licensing scheme to force blogs and such to balance written opinions. Targets will be Fox News, Breitbart, Drudge, Rush, et cetera, et cetera.
What do you think, Susan?
Well, in fact, quite the opposite, sir. Here, what the FCC is doing is saying that the sidewalk has to remain neutral. Any conversation can happen on that sidewalk, but the sidewalk has to stay out of the way. That's all they're doing.
Jeffrey.
Well, in fact, the commission is embarking on the first path, for example, talking about regulating over-the-top services, which are content providers. So the imposition of Title II on the internet ecosystem, and this is why you begin to see companies like Google filing an ex parte at the FCC a couple of days ago saying, well, if you're going to do this Title II thing, which we oppose, you should exempt us in the following ways. So the path to content regulation, to the FCC deciding what kinds of content can be provided, what's discriminatory and not, what's not discriminatory. Again, we've taken the first step down that road today.
Cecilia.
I'm not quite sure if that sounds a little bit separate, but To the caller's concern, it's interesting that those who really support net neutrality say the opposite can happen, that if you don't have net neutrality rules, then you can have, for example, a Verizon deciding to pair up with News Corp more closely, or deciding to pair up with NBC to make sure that MSNBC content is more preferenced and out there, and that say the other side, a more conservative blog might be blocked. So it's, the idea of speech being affected by this, there's a sort of cuts both ways. I think it politically would be very, very difficult to create any sort of regulation on speech within this new regime.
So, Susan, final question. We've got a long road ahead no matter what happens today, correct?
That's true, but the battlefield we're now on is one that's rational. The FCC is acting like a regulatory agency, ensuring that it has firm legal authority over the most important communications medium of our time, and that's what we started down today.
Susan Crawford, Cecilia Kang, Jeffrey Eisenach, what a fascinating discussion, and we'll hear more about what the FCC's decision entails as the day goes on. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.